1,000 pounds to initially get it going. Okay, thanks very much. Roll on to the next question. Thanks very much for answering the question. Makes sense. K2IRW, WB2AHKL. Yeah, Chip, that was not a dumb question. And what Barry is talking about right now is that you can get extremely free power amounts of thrust. There are ionic engines that produce grams or micrograms of thrust in free space, but in free space where there is absolutely no friction. You apply a minuscule amount of force for a long enough period of time, F equals MA, you will eventually create a huge amount of velocity in a very efficient manner. So these ionic engines that are being used in space will eventually allow it to get to extremely high velocity, not in a hurry. Your chemical engine gets you there in a hurry, but you're wasting a whole lot of mass that you're throwing away out the exhaust nozzle in order to get all that huge amount of thrust to get off the ground. Okay, I think it was Eric that wanted to make a further comment on this, and now in that order. KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that thrust, the whole concept of thrust is when you have an action, you get an equal and opposite reaction. So your 100,000 pound jet engine pushing the air through the engine out this port creates a force which creates an equal and opposite force in the other direction which pushes the aircraft forward, and that's Newton's law.
And Newton's third law is action and reaction. If Arnold Schwarzenegger weighs 200 pounds, and he's got a 200 pound barbell in his hand, and he pushes the barbell to the north while he's floating in the space shuttle, he pushes the barbell to the north at 1 meter per second. He's going to move to the south at 1 meter per second because the barbell and him have the identical weight, action and reaction. And in the case of thrust of an engine, that thrust is, you could say it's pushing against the air, though it's not quite right. It's really taking it out of mass, accelerating it through that exhaust nozzle, and that the amount of acceleration of the material coming out of the exhaust nozzle, you're now using F equals MA backwards. That gives you a certain amount of force. And that force with the mass of your spacecraft gives you a certain rate of increase in velocity. And you eventually get moving pretty fast if you've got a low friction environment like free space or a real good set of wheels. N2XJM, K2LIW, Great West.
First, I have a comment, then eventually I have a question that I'm going to wait for. First of all, a glider doesn't need any transforming engine, doesn't need an engine. It could go up and it could accelerate. But there's a mechanism. Now, as far as acceleration, you have a 50 girls pushing the small car. After the moment, you need only two girls. After the moment, you need one finger of one girl to compensate the losses. So it works on the concept of flywheel. The first energy is being stored in motion, and then all you need is to compensate the losses. That's why the heavy car on the railroad is able to be pushed by one person, theoretically, if it is already in motion, and to achieve.
There are a number of systems that have the so-called stick and slip characteristic. If I've got a very smooth table, and I've got a smooth chunk of steel, and I've got oil on the table, and the smooth chunk of steel is sitting on the table, and the chunk of steel has been sitting there for 24 hours, so the chunk of steel is now sitting, steel touching steel at the table, and it has pushed the oil off to one side. I first start moving that block by pushing it with my finger. Steel versus steel is scraping against each other, and at first it may require quite a bit of force for anything to start happening. After you start moving the block, and some of the oil is now getting wiped underneath the steel block, and now you've got an oil film between the steel block and the steel table, all of a sudden very little force is required to keep the block moving. So that's an example of what's called stick and slip characteristics. There are a number of things that to make them break the motion at first requires a bigger amount of force than required to maintain the motion later on. In the case of an automobile sitting in your yard for 24 hours, the bottom of your tires are taking a set because they're pressing against the road. The bottom of your tire has got a D-shaped dent in it. So when you first start pushing the car, it's difficult. Pretty soon, when the car gets rolling, the tires start smoothing out, become more round, and maintaining motion becomes a lot easier. So explaining the difference between starting force and maintaining velocity force is very different at times. Let me drop this little point here. In the case of a sailplane or any other kind of aircraft, you're almost always trading off potential energy of altitude versus kinetic energy of motion. Your sailplane, most of the time, by some means, has to be towed to a high altitude. So the sailplane has got a certain amount of mass. You've towed to a high altitude. You've now got a mass against gravity at an altitude that's got a certain amount of potential energy. As you start flying your sailplane in calm air, you're always increasing in altitude because you're trading off potential energy of altitude. You're losing some of that altitude, but getting forward velocity and maintaining forward flight and overcoming the flying resistance, so to speak, the atmospheric drag on the airplane. And if you can find a place where the air is rising faster than you think, when you're at the maximum efficiency of glide, then your sailplane can gain altitude because Mother Nature with their thermals is giving you this extra energy. You're not getting something for nothing. You're just finding a very inexpensive way of getting free energy because of the rising airs. Hawks and very many other birds use this phenomenon. Let me drop this. A real efficient albatross or hawk or many other birds are able to sense where Mother Nature has rising columns of air, thermals, and by just holding their wings out there steady and keep flying into those thermals with circles in them, they can be rising to high altitude without using a whole lot of muscle power to do it. And so a good bird can also have an albatross, for instance, that's got a very high lift-drag ratio. He's got a very efficient wing, very long wing, I think something like 6 meters at times, and 6 meters or 3 meters, but he's got a very big wing, a very efficient wing, and under certain conditions, he can fly for a long time without using any muscle power, just holding his wing steady in one particular position. The next person on our list was Charles, KD2, Kilo November Hotel. Hope we haven't put Charles to sleep. KD2, Kilo November Hotel, if I got it correctly. KQID, go ahead, Charles.
WS1.
Always enjoy the net. Very interesting net tonight. And I have the simplest question of the night, I believe. I was just looking to see if anybody was aware of whether the fusion repeater was active at this time. I was never able to connect to it.
Can I answer that for you?
You've got it, Eric. And then after that, I'm going to pick up the phone. You got it, Eric.
Now, there's a few of them around. I don't know all the frequencies, but the one that I do know about, which is in Plainview, is 146. Let me get back to you in a second. I'll look it up. I've got it in my radio.
Okay, while we're waiting for Eric, Paul, you're going to straighten us out on some of these things we discussed just about, and pretty soon we're going to be going over to your... we got to go to the mailbag first, but we're going to get to your space report. And I got some interesting information that was in the latest issue, the December issue of Scientific American. WS2N, K2RIW, keep the phone.
And I got it, Dick.
Hey, Eric.
I still have a question waiting.
And don't forget about John, KD2IXT. I think he was up early on the list of questions.
Yeah, I turned it over to IXP twice, and he didn't answer at that time. I'll go back to him. While we're waiting for Eric, W2N, go right ahead with your comment or question on poll.
Got it now.
Solved the problem, but I always thought of it as, let's say, you take that 747, I'll use round numbers, I think it's like 900,000 pounds, but let's call it 1,000,000 pounds. The jet engines, I think, are like 54,000 pounds each. There's about four of them on there, so we'll call them 50,000 pounds each. But the wheel acts like the center of the wheel where the axle is, acts like a fulcrum. So let's say the wheel is 4 feet in diameter. So you have 2 feet from the axle to the ground, and the jet engines are mounted on the wing. Let's call that about 20 feet above the ground. So it's roughly a 10-to-1 ratio. If that center of the wheel, the axle, is acting as a fulcrum, and it's really one big lever to start that plane rolling. So you're going to take 20 feet high compared to 2 feet. It's probably a 10-to-1 ratio. So 10-to-1, if you have a 50,000 pound engine, that all of a sudden becomes a 500,000 pound push. And now if you have four of them, and now you're already up to 2 million pounds. So you're able to roll that, get that big airplane rolling. That's the way I think of it, Dick. Back to you. WS West.
Yeah, I'm going to have a further comment on that one in the poll, but let's go back to Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW, go ahead, Eric.
It's 146.745. It does both modes. It does fusion, does wide, does narrow, and it also does the analog. I think the analog is 136.5 for the PL.
Anything true on that, Charlie?
It's been while in plain view and wasn't able to connect, whereas I have connected to other fusion repeaters. But, okay, I'll keep that in mind. Thank you.
Bronco 1 in the hospital. I don't know what the big
I'm hearing a word that I'm not familiar with, Eric, and this is a pretty dumb question on my part. What is a fusion repeater or fusion mode? What does the word fusion mean? Over to you, Eric, K2EJ, K2IW.
Fusion is Yates' trademark name for the digital and analog system. Sort of like DMR. It's C4FM, it's 4FSK is what it is. And, it uses a similar codec, actually, the vocoder, as they call it. It's actually better on fusion because it runs at a much higher bit rate than DMR. Single channel P25 is similar to it. And there's quite a few of them around. We've eaten two of them, like a hit in Hawaii. So. That's the ASU answer to VTOS.
Getting the impression that these digital modes are going to catch on. That was a joke. Paul, you talked about the lever arm of the height of engines above the wheel, and I'm going to ask you this question. If I decided to build a very dumb type of 747 airplane, which I think is the example you were using, and I'm only going to rolling it across the runway and pretend to really fly it. And each of the engines are measured, are mounted to a pylon that's mounted to the wing. And if in my dumb design, I stretch those pylons, so now that the engines go all the way down to the ground and the engine is almost scraping the ground. So each of the four engines are mounted on very long pylons connected to a very stiff wing. And the engines are now all the way down to the ground. With the amount of thrust required on this airplane, the only thing I change is the length of the pylons. Would the amount of thrust required to roll that aircraft across the runway be any different with the engines much lower to the ground? WS2N, K2LIW.
If the engine is, the structural part of the engine has to leave from, leave that engine from somewhere. So if that structural part is attached to the same location where mine is, then, the force would be the same.
But if you put the attachment, let's say, below the axle, I would say you're not going to go anywhere. You're just going to drag that. In other words, you have any kind of a wheel is a lever effect. So if the force is, let's say, like I said, 20 feet above, and my engine and your engine could be higher or lower, but if it's still connected in that same location, you would have the same stress on that fulcrum, that axle. No matter where you put the engine, back to them.
When the aircraft is being backed out of stall by the ground towing vehicle, it moves the airplane by applying a certain amount of force, usually to the nose wheel. That ground towing vehicle requires a certain amount of force to make the aircraft roll on the ground. If I'm using the engine instead, assuming I'm using the towing vehicle to tow the aircraft in a forward direction, and I'm measuring the amount of force on the tongue of that towing vehicle that's doing the moving of the aircraft. And now I measure the amount of thrust on the engines to move the aircraft at the exact same velocity. Is the thrust of the engines different than the force of the towing vehicle? The same amount of speed rolling across the ground? WS2N, K2LIW.
Well, the volume of it would be a heck of a lot more. But the strain, I would say, initially is the same. But I'm just saying, you've got to have like a leverage type of an effect on any kind of an axle. That's really the point I'm trying to make. Oh, yeah, I mean, it's the old story about taking a guy who's lifted weights his whole life and stands in front of a plane and puts a rope around his teeth and drags the plane down the runway. I get that. Back to you, sir.
If that ground-mounted towing vehicle can continuously move that 747 forward across the runway with 1,000 pounds of force, and now I disconnect the towing vehicle and I set the engine to give me 1,000 pounds of thrust total, would the aircraft move at the same speed? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, I don't think his initial pull is going to be the same, but you're going to get up to a certain speed, and that's going to be it. With the jet engines, you're going to be able to get up to 150 miles an hour, whatever it is, just for a takeoff, and then the towing vehicle can't do that.
And what I'm saying, Paul, is that to roll steady forward at, let me pick it up, 5 miles an hour for the towing vehicle, I know it's probably less than 1,000 pounds required. And if I set my engines for 1,000 pounds of thrust, I think I can continuously keep moving forward at 5 miles an hour. So the height of the engine above the ground doesn't matter, in my opinion, because the nose wheel is so far ahead of the wheels that are connected to the wings, the aircraft doesn't get a chance to tilt very much, even though you've got a lever on. The thrust of the engines is further above the ground than the towing vehicle, and you get a little bit of a downward tilt of the aircraft. The suspension system on the nose wheel gets compressed a little bit more when you use the engines than when you use the towing vehicle. But the force is force. And so whether the force is high or low on a level aircraft running across the runway, or whether I'm towing it with the vehicle, I think the same amount of pounds of force is required. You're just deciding whether or not you're going to do it with an engine or doing it with a towing vehicle. And yes, there is a lever arm inside of the wheel itself, between the axle of the wheel and the contact point on the road. There is a kind of an axle there, and without a doubt, the force of the engine is applied to that moment arm of that axle to wheel contact with the runway, and that does overcome the rolling resistance of that wheel. So there is a local lever arm there. You are also creating a lever arm between the wheel and way up high where the engine is. And that particular lever arm may not be part of this situation, because the aircraft stays level to the ground no matter where you're applying the force, within reason. It's a bunch of opinions. I think we've gone down the list of everybody who checked in. Let me check now. Let's go back to John. We skipped John. KD2IX.
Repeater, time out.
KD2IXP. John, are you there? KD2IXP on the TechNet. Now, under normal circumstances, Wes, you said you had another question. Under normal circumstances, the question and answer period is for the first hour, and then we go over to the mailbag. We've now used an hour and 23, we've used 2 hours and 23 minutes on the so-called 1 hour question period. Therefore, Wes, I'm going to ask you to be friendly with us. If you believe your question is a very brief question, go for it. If you think it's not a brief question, because we are an hour and a quarter late to our next section of the TechNet, I'd rather not go into a deep question at this time. However, we can put you number one on the runway next week if we don't get a chance to carry you this week. In 2XJN, I hope you got a brief one, K2RAW in the TechNet.
I have a better solution for it. I asked a question if you can answer later on. Okay, the electromagnetic radiation, because you were talking about the polarization. A photon is an elementary particle of radiation and the force carrier for electromagnetic force, but the thing is that photon is completely free of electrical charge and not the infrared magnetic field that cannot be polarized. So there is a kind of puzzle in here. I thought that would be an entertaining question. Some people say that name electromagnetic spectrum then is misleading. But, yeah, I was trying to make some point. And to actually.
Yeah, photons are wild objects. They have essentially zero mass, and they move at the speed of light in vacuum, and yet they have momentum. You can take photons, hit them against a solar sail, and get thrust out of that. So photons with essentially no mass still have some momentum, and that's quite puzzling to a whole lot of people. And when it comes to electromagnetic radiation, light, infrared, radio, ultraviolet, X-ray, whatever, all of the spectrum from DC to light of electromagnetic radiation, very few people will say that is not an electromagnetic wave. Just about everything from a little bit above DC frequencies to a little bit below cosmic ray frequencies, almost everybody will call that electromagnetic radiation. It's got an E field and an H field to it. It's what an awful lot of people say. Not easy to accept all the time. We'll get into that a little more next week. What kind of mailbag response we had this week, John? KC2WGB with the mailbag. Awful late. K2IW TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, but an exciting night. A lot of good questions today. Got a couple of questions. Plus, the Echolink is varying between 8 and 10, so I've got a good attendance there. Chat room slow. All right, give me a drop. I'll go on to my first question. You can set this gentleman's mind at ease. Okay, this is a nice quick one. This gentleman has a tape deck, and he has an audio input line. And what he wants to do is record his radio through the audio output jack. Now, is there any difference being that this is an RF radio with the audio input jack, and can he use it safely with his tape recorder? If you could help out on that, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
With almost any kind of a portable radio-like device, cell phone or whatever, which has an audio output jack, but it has a radio function where it can really transmit like a cell phone. If the manufacturer has done a good job, that audio output jack has almost nothing but audio and maybe some DC voltage. The amount of RF voltage on that jack usually is kept very small for a bunch of reasons. It would be inefficient to do it any other way. I mean, your antenna inside is specifically designed for the radio frequency, and there's an antenna tuner in there, by the way, most cell phones. Taking your poorly tuned antenna and forcing it to resonate on that particular frequency it's using at this time. So if any of that RF energy inside the box starts leaking away to the audio circuitry, to the output audio connector, it would represent a waste of the antenna pattern you're going to get from that wiring. Is going to probably interfere, create null in the pattern of the real design antenna inside. So the amount of RF energy on that audio output jack is probably going to be 60 decibels weaker than the RF energy that's on the real antenna. That's a rough number. But to make it any different would be a very poor design. Let me drop it. Now, if you're asking the question, can you find somebody's brand X design, a cell phone, or whatever kind of radio equipment that has a poorly designed audio circuit where there's a lot of RF energy on the audio circuit, that is possible. But the amount of RF there is probably very small, even in a poor design case. If you're worried about radio frequency biohazard, it turns out that when enough radio energy is hitting your body such that you would be at the point of potential damage to your body, with rare exception, you're going to feel it. You're going to sense the heat. When RF energy hits a human being, almost every bit of it that gets absorbed by the human being gets turned into heat. The American National Standard Institute, C95 report, Charlie 95 report, which gets updated every couple of years, and it's now been around for 60 years. It's got roughly 1,000 references of the world's best testing laboratories and institutions. It is the defining document for the United States. It's the defining document for the Department of Defense and NIOSH and OSHA. And Europe has their defining document. Asia has their defining document. They all hang together. Let me drop. Inside of those 1,000 references of the C95 report, lots and lots of people have looked for the non-thermal effect. They assume that RF energy is going to be rectified by the nervous system and start creating phony nervous signals. People have looked for that effect. They can't find it. So from all of the 60 years of research of the American National Standards Institute, RF energy only creates heating. And so when you get to the level of milliwatts per square centimeter, which is above the threshold of maximum exposure permitted, rare, most of the time you will feel the heat. If there was enough RF energy on that audio circuit going into that earpiece, that's going to do you damage. When that wiring lays against your face, you're going to feel the heat from it if there was a whole lot of RF energy on it. And by the way, if you took all the energy of the antenna inside of that radio, and you press that radio up against the side of your head like you use a cell phone, you know that darn well you don't feel that heat. It's nowhere near the level that can create damage. The most sensitive part of the human being is the human eye, because it doesn't have very much fluid flow, therefore it doesn't have very much natural cooling. Let me drop this. The thing you and I are usually most concerned about, am I putting too much RF energy into my brain? Well, the good news is the brain has got an extremely prodigious blood flow. The amount of capillaries carrying blood through your brain, because when you're resting, 40% of all the energy being used by your body is being consumed by that brain. There's a whole lot of fluid flow of blood going through that brain. That's a beautiful natural cooling system. The amount of RF energy you have to put into a brain to exceed the amount of heat or the cooling capability of all that blood, it's a very big number. The current standards on that are extremely conservative. In other words, there's now about 100-to-1 safety factor built into that standard because various people thought that that's the right political thing to do. The original measurement was done on the red eye of a white rabbit. They clamped him into a fixture, clamped his eye open, and started exposing microwave energy into his eye. And until they got up to 100 milliwatts per square centimeter and above, that was the threshold where he was would eventually develop a cataract. And so they divided by 10, and so for the first 30 years or so of the ANSI report, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter was considered safe. Recently, it's lowered to 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. And is there good physical reason for it? Probably not. It's mostly ultra-conservative, as I see it. And the real problem here is a problem of vocabulary. It's called RF radiation. Had the original engineers, let me grab it. And the original engineers decided to call a radio signal coming off of an antenna as RF signaling and RF communicating and RF propagating instead of RF radiation, we wouldn't have this problem. The word RF radiation, radiation is an emotional word. Perfectly good word until World War II came along and all of a sudden we had nuclear radiation. And the number of people who confuse nuclear radiation with RF radiation is huge. Nuclear radiation consists of subatomic, atomic level particles that are moving across the speed of light, and when they penetrate your body, they can do damage. They can disturb your DNA, for instance. Radio energy, the individual particles of radio energy, don't have the power to do that. It becomes a rather simple heat wave into your body, if you know what I mean. So the relationship between the two is very remote. But because of that common word, radiation, it creates a lot of alarm in a lot of people's minds. And as such, you, a town like Bayville, Long Island, where the residents of Bayville for the last 8 or so years have been attempting to remove all antennas from their town. They don't want that RF radiation in their town. They want the cell phone antennas removed. They want the police antennas removed. They want the fire antennas removed. They want the ambulance antennas removed because they believe it's creating damage to the residents of that town. And so these are serious people trying to protect their children. They believe they're doing the right thing. But there's an awful lot of smarter people who think they are misinterpreting the words, the vocabulary, and the amount of people who will die in that town. Let me drop.
Have a comment.
If the people in that town were successful in removing all of those antennas, the number of people in the town who would die in emergency situations would drastically increase. It's a fruitless effort on what seems like a logical thing to do. The residents of the town will not, most of them will not use their cell phone in the house when the child is there. They will not use their microwave oven. They do use their portable telephone, their wireless telephone. Somehow, they don't consider that one. And so, that's just the way they believe. And that's not the only town that's doing that, but Bayville is the strongest one. And so, for a whole lot of years, there was a website called BRAC, B-R-A-C, Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers. And that website collected every possible article they could find, which tells you about all the damage to human beings from radio circuits. These were very poorly documented cell sites that had that. They were not traceable to the Bureau, but those people strongly believe that they would be better off if all antennas were moved into somebody else's town. And what effect it had on that town, they weren't concerned with that. Just move all those antennas out of this town was their effect. It was their desire. If they succeeded, they would have created an awful lot of trouble. WS2N, N2XJN, KQIW, go ahead, Wes.
You're perfectly right. The higher the frequency, the more energy is per period. So one period, up, down, up, to zero, has more energy. So it gets so much energy that this energy could, all the photon, we were talking about the photon, could damage the body of the person. So it will be interesting discussion next week about it. You're completely right. That is the interaction between electromagnetic field and the body.
Okay, Wes. John, KC2WGB. You want to go through this one a little bit further? Or do you want to go to the next one? This place is yours. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. The only thing you forgot to mention, Dick, was that exposure that you mentioned with the rabbit. It requires 6 minutes to do any damage. So That's another point. And maybe they could work on stopping the sun radiation, too, in that town, and they'd be happy with that. All right, let me let this drop, and I'll go on to my next one. Good answers, though. Okay, this gentleman is looking to spend some money on a drone for his son, who is 11 years old, and he's listening on a scanner because he was told to acquire information from here. He sent me an email. Now, he'd like to know, he's looking at a drone, approximately $250. He didn't mention if it has a camera or not. Maybe at that price it does. But for an 11-year-old, do you think that's a practical gift? And we get some sufficient use out of it. Kid is very bright. He's into sciences and just wants a drone. What do you think, Dick? Back to you, KC2WCB.
There are lots and lots of people buying these drones with cameras these days and flying them. And to see a picture of your house top view from 100, 200, 300, 400 feet, to fly a drone at the maximum altitude that's legal, 400 feet as long as you're far enough away from an airport, and look at all the territory around your town and the top view of your town, and off at a 45 degree angle, that's an awful lot of fun. And so, are there people 11 years of age doing that? Absolutely. When it comes to quarter scale radio control model aircraft being flown under the rules of the AMA, the Academy of Model Aeronautics, which, by the way, when you sign up for that AMA license, which allows you to compete in radio control model aircraft competition, which, by the way, includes quadcopters, or includes these drones. And so that is an event that's being included in some of the AMA sanctioned contests these days. And so with that AMA license comes, as I said, with their membership, you get $2 million worth of liability insurance. And the youngest flyer I've ever seen fly an extremely high power aircraft was a guy who was 5 years of age with specific training from his father, was able to do some very elaborate aerobatic maneuvers with an extremely high power helicopter aircraft, electrically powered helicopter, which is an even higher power version of a drone. So with proper training, with proper supervision, can an 11-year-old safely fly a drone? Absolutely. It's being done all the time in AMA events. Let me drop it. Now, among the LIMOC membership, there are a number of members who get pretty serious with drones. Arguably, the best expert we have on that subject is a guy named Jay, KC2YSK, Kilo Charlie 2, Yankee Sierra Kilowatt. You go to the YouTube videos that Jay has published in which he flies over his Dix Hills house. You see those beautiful views of his house flying on the expressway and whatever. Winter, summer, spring, fall. He's got a number of YouTube videos. So with your QFZ.com and with your LIMOC roster, by one means or another, you can find Jay's last name, KC2YSK. It's Marcucci, M-A-R-C-U-C-C-I. If you Google the word, if you go to YouTube video and you will put in the right search word to find the YouTube videos from Jay Marcucci, M-A-R-C-U-C-C-I, and you look at those videos, you'll know what a modern-day quadcopter with built-in beautiful camera and stabilizer is able to do. These things are a little bit pricey, but Jay has also experimented with some of the very low-priced versions. As we said, let me drop it. Arguably, Jay is the expert on that particular subject because he's been doing this now for about a year, maybe even longer. He's been a radio control model enthusiast for many years, but he's been flying drones for a few years. He's one of at least two or three people I can think of. So by way of the YouTube videos, you can see what he's done, and you'll get a good idea as to what you're getting involved in. And now there's a little bit of a trade-off of how much performance you want versus how many dollars you're willing to spend. But the fact that the person is 11 years of age, that is not a gating item. As I said, there are quite a few licensed Academy of Model Aeronautic members with their membership very high power radio controlled aircraft under proper supervision, and very few accidents are taking place, if you know what I mean. So it can be done safely with the right supervision. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, very good. I'm sure he's going to have a ball with the thing comes Christmas, but that'll be a nice surprise. Yeah, I agree. I think 11 years old, and especially he's a bright kid, I think he could master that without any problem at all. Before I go on, I just have to make a brief announcement for Bob DET about Richie. Let me let it drop. As many out there may know or may not know, Richie had a second amputation. He's in the hospital. And Bob gave me a phone call for people who'd like to call him. He'd like to get some phone calls. He's pretty lonely. And I'll give you that number. It's 631-855-6423. That's 631-855-6423. And that's for N2EO, who is in the hospital. All right, let me let it drop and I'll go on to my next one, Dick.
Twice, John, you said Bob DET. Does DET represent his call letters? That's not quite clear what you mean by the John. Go ahead.
Yes, Bob Guy. DET, the suffix of his call sign. Everybody knows him. He's on the lot.
Do you know the prefix of call letters?
I think it's N2.
So if I understand correctly, Bob is keeping track of Rich's situation and so on. 631-855-6423. And sorry to hear that some further medical conditions have occurred there. Over to you, John, for the next mailbag. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, second amputation of his other leg, so not a good thing. All right. All right, let me look up to the second question, a quickie. All right. You might not know the answer to this one, Dick, but I'm sure somebody out there listening would be able to chime in. This gentleman's looking for a Christmas gift for his son, who is intensely interested in CW. He wants to buy a code practice oscillator. And this young man who wants to learn the code, he knows a little bit of already, wants to be a brass doctor, so he, you know, wants a simple brass key and a code oscillator. But the father knows there are other types of keys. Do you know, or anybody listening, know of a good code practice oscillator that can take all the new type of keys along with the old brass key, and the kid could have some fun? That information would be helpful for him, Dick. Over to you, KC2WGB.
Let me ask for a clarification on this one, John. When you say new kinds of keys, other than the J38 simple up-down Morse code type key, or the Vibraplex horizontally operated automatic dot indicator, or some of the more modern kinds of keys where you move the paddle to the left, it continuously makes dots, you move the paddle to the right, it continuously makes dashes, or vice versa, and if you squeeze the two paddles together, it continuously makes da-da, 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 or depending on the order in which you squeeze the two paddles together, it makes dodges, dodges, dodges continuously. So, there are kinds of quasi-automatic keying devices that can help you make rather efficient, high-speed Morse code. Is that the kind of keys you're talking about, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely correct, Dick. Yeah, he's interested in the brass key. This is what the child is giving him, but the father knows that eventually he's going to want to get onto the more advanced type of keys as he proceeds along the line. So if anybody knows a good code practice oscillator, maybe UPS might know, but somebody out there, that information would be helpful. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'd like to believe if you do the right kind of a Google search, with the right search words on modern-day Morse code, code practice oscillators, and so on, you'll get some hints. I'd like to believe that by way of eBay, there are things you can buy. So, of you guys out there who are, some of you, very enthusiastic about Morse code, does anybody know of a brand name of a code practice oscillator? Or, in some cases, there are certain radios you can buy, which have built-in function with the radio, so with the right kind of elaborate keying device on the outside, it'll give you automatic dots and dashes and da-da's and da-da's. So when it comes to fancy Morse code keying techniques, you guys with the sound of our voice, tell us a brand name and model number of either a code practice oscillator or radio that is so equipped. K2LIW listening.
And Nick, he's willing to spend $300 and change.
He can buy a lot of radio for that money. Okay, you guys out there with suggestions, give us your call letters right now.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. Anything else?
Yeah, how you doing, Dick? K2RIW. Whiskey Bravo 2, Charlie Lima, November.
Okay, we've got both Paul, WS2N, and WB2CLN. Paul first, WS2N, go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, if he's going to spend that much money, that's one question I wanted to find out. How much is he going to spend? Is he eventually going to hook him up to a radio? But the iambic keyer by MFJ, you know, it's an electronic keyer, it's a paddle. I have the, you know, MFJ model, 422B, 422 Bravo. Now they make a little bit more modern ones. But they're about the same. They go for around 145, and you still see them advertised in QST. I like it because it has, you know, you can hear the tone. So if he doesn't, if he's not ready for a radio, you know, you could hear this all day long just with the keyer itself. You don't need to, you know, plug it into a real radio. But when the time comes, you know, they have the ports on the back, RCA ports, you just plug it into your radio and off you go. It's got a volume control, you can change the speed on it, and you'd be all set. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Paul. Sounds like a lot of fun. Out of curiosity, Paul, with your DXing, how often do you use Morse code? Possibly 30% of the time, and sideband the rest of the time? Over to you, Paul.
The other way around, 80% CW and 20% there. On phone, I just worked Columbia on phone the other day, and that was the list. But if you were to look at my log, I would say 80% of CW.
Fantastic. What roughly is your code speed today, Paul? Or what's the highest it's ever been? Over to you, Paul.
Well, 20 to receive. You need that for the test, the extra test. And I'm comfortable, very comfortable listening to the 18 words per minute on the bulletins that they always send from Newington, Connecticut, on the air. You know, they send that on all the bands. That always comes at 18 words a minute. No more than that. If you listen to just call letters, yeah, I could go 25 words per minute, you know, for a contest or something. No problem. But, you know, you get involved in QSO, you got to slow down a little bit. Back to you.
QQQIQ, Glenn recognized. Paul, you said 20 is required for the extra class license. The extra class license used to require the demonstration of 20 words per minute code speed. I think lately all licenses no longer require Morse code capability. Am I wrong on that one? WS2N, K2RIW?
Oh, yeah, you're right. I'm talking about when I took the test. So that's why I needed the 20 words per minute. Back then, yeah, you needed 5 for novice, 13 for general and 20 for extra. So, there you go. Now, the straight key is good. One guy said, oh, don't get used to the straight key, you know, go right with the iambic. I find there's no difference. In fact, I have these things set up in parallel because this next month we have straight key night. So then I just use the straight key. You know, that's always on New Year's Eve, that 24-hour period. back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Paul. Right now, we've got both Tom and Glenn in that order with further information on this subject. WB2CLM, go right ahead, Tom. What's your favorite Morse code device? The smart guys in Flushing, what are they using these days? You've got it, Tom.
Didn't know it was all going to be talking about Morse code, my God. But anyway, how you doing, Dick? I haven't talked to you in a while. We go back to, I believe, the late 1960s. I hope you remember me there. I think you do. Of course, we met. You came over to my parents' house in the early 70s. Anyway, I talk to you a lot on 432 sideband, but I have a question about EchoLink with a cell phone, but nothing about Morse code. Oh, hell, Morse code. Hey, I've been in advanced class since the late 1980s, and I made it up to 19 words a minute. I passed the extra class theory, and my buddies, I was living up in Schenectady at the time, and my buddies were saying, come on, you can do it, God, you hit another barrier there, and I never bothered, and of course, there's no more code needed now. So, there you have it. So, me and Morse code, that's what I think. Hey, with all the digital modes available, I shouldn't put it down. It looks like there is a resurgence of Morse code. But anyway, Dick, since you're running this, I have a question to everyone there in regards to EchoLink on an Android cell phone. Go ahead.
Okay, if we had Eric available, he could be able to answer that question. Let's find out if Eric is available. KE2EJ, KE2IW, go ahead, Eric. Yeah, I think Eric is the only person that could answer that. When it comes to signing up for questions for the TechNet tonight, that was supposed to take place between 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and we're way beyond the question and answer period, so we're a little bit late. I've got you listed as a question for next week. You're going to be on the runway for next week. We've also got John, KD2IXB, and W2XJ, and both want to ask questions next week. So our question and answer period on new subjects, we've gone way beyond that time, Tom, so please bear with us. Glenn, I think you wanted to make a comment of the subject. It's on the desk right now, on the table right now. Morse code, fancy tears. KC2QIQ, K2IW, Glenn.
6DBZ, I want to make a comment also there.
You're right, it's Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Suzette. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I have a couple of keys. I've got a straight tone here that I use for straight keys, and I've got a cornucopia of the iambic keys, everything from Drake, MFJ. But I guess there was one part of the question that I thought the person was asking was, is there one keyer that does both straight key, in other words, if you just want to use a straight key, or an iambic keyer? And I don't have one that does that. I was wondering if anybody knew if there's one or if that even was the original question. But back to the K2R, I think it's 2QIQ. I think he's going to need 2Qs, is what I think.
That's right, Glenn. That was the question, yes.
Yeah, if I understand correctly, John, he wants to start off with a simple straight J J-38 like here, but he wants to buy something that has the later ability to accept iambic keyers.
Exactly.
And from what Glenn is telling us, that's not likely. Let's see what Hal's got to say on this one. K6DPZ. Hal, make sure you wait for the four beeps, and then tell us your information on iambic versus regular keyers on a Morse code, you know what I mean, a Morse code circuit. You got it, Hal. K2RIW.
K2RIW, intensive application for DPZ. Well, most of the newer amateur radio transceivers out there have built-in keyers. Iambic and straight key. A lot of radios have it built internally. Well, I wanted to mention that a new net is being organized on 3700 KCs for QRP-CW. We haven't set the date yet, but the guys are already interested. Maximum power, we'd like to have people check in with, like under 5 watts, and it's going to be a net. And we're going to get the best time. So far, there's about 7 people who want to get involved with it. And once you get the idea of the best time, the best day, we brought up to do it at 8 o'clock, so we're near that time on Sunday. I said, no way. This has to be independent of, you know, any other net. But it's CW, it's going to be on 3,700 KC. The reason for that frequency, number one, the early novice license many years ago, they were licensed on 80, 40, and 15 meters. Hold on.
Yeah, it used to be 3,750. Wait till the beep.
The words right out of my mouth. And the 7150 is the 7200. This is at 21215 to 21350, if I remember correctly. Well, it's going to be interesting yet, and people are going to be welcome. And next week, we should be able to tell what the day will be, but the frequency will be 3700 right in the money. And the beauty of a frequency like that for a net is any old receiver, you have a 100 KC calibrator, you can dial it right up to 3700, you know your receiver is set. So that was my only comment. I wish everybody having a good week. Go ahead, just pick it back up. Kilowatt 6, David Peterson.
Next.
A good Morse code capability to both transmit and receive Morse code is an art form that a certain percentage of amateurs, like for instance Paul WS2N, really enjoy it. One of the early almost founders of the TechNet was Mel K2KEY, now a silent key. But he used to enjoy Morse code so much that he would play a tape of Morse code into an earpiece under his pillow. And he listened to Morse code as he went to sleep every night. It calmed his nerves and it gave him a lot of pleasure. So, people who, as they get very highly skilled with Morse code, they don't just hear sounds and convert it into letters. They hear combinations of Morse code sounds, and at first they start hearing it as words, and eventually they start hearing it as phrases and sentences. There are certain key English words that are so easily repeated that that has a very characteristic sound. Best example I can think of, let me drop. It's not a very common word, but it's got a nice swing to it. The word bent, B-E-N-T. Baker, Echo, November, Tango, B-E-N-T. When you hear it in Morse code, it's da-da-da-da-da-da. It's got an interesting slang, it's got an interesting swing to it, if you know what I mean. There are certain words that when you hear that combination of sounds, you know right away, you're hearing the word, not individual letters. The word committee, which has double M's and double E's to it, so for instance, and commission. There are certain. Okay, back to you, John, if you got another one. KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2RIW and the TechNet. And how many sign-ins? I think you said we had 8 or so sign-ins on the full link. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, we had up to 10. Now we have 7 sitting there. GB, back to you, Dick.
Okay, we're going to go over to Rich right now. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. Mobile. Somewhere in Pennsylvania, maybe. K2RIW. Rich, go ahead with your information. You're a Morse code operator from way back.
Katie, you've been mobile yesterday. I have about 30 different keys right now, all different types. And They do make unit fiberglass cells and dual units that have a straight key and a single paddle, or straight key and dual paddle, that you can use it with an iambic here.